Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, could dorm-style living help ease the Valley's housing shortage?
And as the last penny is minted, we meet a local artist who's made art out of pennies for decades.
But first, since President Donald Trump took office, the southern border between the U.S. and Mexico has been all but abandoned. What had been packed with record numbers of migrants coming to the U.S. to seek asylum under the Biden administration not long ago is now largely empty as migrants have pretty much stopped coming. Our first guest this morning had been to the border and documented that decline, but he also wanted to see what was happening further south. Daniel Gonzalez covers immigration for the Arizona Republic, and he went to two main gateways along the migrant route to the U.S. to find out. He went between Guatemala and Mexico and to the Darien Gap between Colombia and Panama. He expected to see the same drop in migration that he saw reporting along the U.S.-Mexico border. And he did see that drop. But he also saw something else that surprised him. People going back.
These changes practically happened overnight. And really, it owes to the power of social media. So people were aware that the border had been shut down when the Trump administration went into effect back in January. They knew that people who were crossing the border were being arrested instead of being allowed into the United States, which is what was happening under the Biden administration. But what was really driving this change was the images that people were seeing on TikTok of people being arrested, these very heavy-handed military-style arrests taking place in the United States. Those take place one day, and they're on social media within hours. And that was what was surprising to us, to see that people were seeing these images on TikTok, and that was discouraging them from, if they were en route, there was encouraging them to turn around and go back. It was encouraging people not to leave their countries. And also, what was surprising is how many people we met who had actually made it to the United States, were living here, and were now headed home, had left, self-deported.
Wow.
And were headed home.
I mean, the Trump administration has talked about encouraging people to self-deport because of their strong-handed approach. So, I mean, from what you saw, it's working.
Yes, I was surprised to see how many people we met who had actually been in, living in the interior of the United States. We met a guy who was living in Kingman, for example. I met people who were living in Kentucky, many, many states throughout the United States who had actually seen ICE raids taking place in their own communities or on television or on social media and said, you know what, I don't want to take the chance of being put in detention and flown home. I'm going to try to get back on my own.
Okay, so going home, the big question there, and you profiled a lot of people in this series who were on that route home. What are they going home to? I mean, they fled for a reason, right?
They're going home to the exact same conditions they left. And that's what that kind of raises the question is, these policies have been very effective in not only stopping people coming to the United States, but encouraging people to go back. And also people are being deported in large numbers. But the situations in these countries like Venezuela, Colombia, Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, those are all the countries, some of the main sending countries. The conditions there have not changed. And if anything, they've gotten worse. So people who are going back, they're going to face a lot of uncertainty, difficulties finding jobs, economic crises. Violence, political upheaval, all those things haven't changed. So it raises the question is, how effective are these policies going to be in the long term? We've seen this dramatic decrease in the number of people coming and also an increase in people returning. But the experts that I interviewed use this term, the ballooning effect. What's happening now is that there will be this pressure that will start to grow in these countries. People either will try to go back to their own countries or go to other parts of Latin America, waiting for that opportunity down the road to maybe go back to another country or possibly the United States. So will we see those waves of migrants in the future? I think it's very likely. Will that be in weeks, months, years down the road? That's what we don't know.
Yeah. So some of the people you profiled here were being flown back to kind of very far south parts of Mexico, often where they were not from, right? And you have this quote in here. These are people who are basically gringos at this point, and they're undergoing this really big shock because they might be from these countries, but they might have been in the U.S. for a very long time, it sounds like. Tell us about some of those folks.
Sure, sure. So this is a new policy that's under the Trump administration. We've always deported people to Mexico, both at the land ports and also by planes. Mm-hmm. That's been happening for a long time. What's new is the United States is flying the majority of people who are being deported to Mexico are being flown to the most southern tips of Mexico, the farthest that you can get from the United States, 2,000 miles away in many cases.
Right.
And the idea is that those folks will be less likely to come back to the United States if they're so far away. But many of the people that we met, this was what was really shocking, is that there weren't people who had recently crossed the border. There were many people who had been living in the United States for decades. For example, we met people who hadn't lived in the United States. They had left Mexico when they were 7 or 8 years old.
Wow.
And they're getting off the plane, and really it was like a foreign country to them. They had never been there. They had no recollection of being in Mexico. They spoke English much better than they spoke Spanish. I remember this one guy I went up to, fluent English speaker, and I said, and he was from somewhere in northern Mexico, and he was arriving in southern Mexico, and he had a figure out how am I going to get back to, you know, where I'm from originally, mm-hmm. and what am I going to do when I get there?
There's a program, though, like Mexico is sort of prepared for this. So many people are having this experience that they have, like, systems in place to try to handle it.
Yeah, like the place that we met folks, so when people arrive, they land at the airport there in Tapachula, and then they put them on buses and they bring them to a reception center that's been set up outside their main soccer stadium. It's basically in a parking lot.
Yeah.
And when the migrants arrive on these buses, they go inside and they're basically reoriented into their own country. And you have to imagine, if you haven't lived in a country for decades, you don't have something as simple as an ID. So that's one of the main things that they do there is they look them up in their system and they try to find some records of them, and then they give them an ID so that allows them to travel in Mexico, wherever they're trying to get to. They give them some food. They give them some clothing. They give them a chance to take a shower. They do health screenings. They give them it's really just a couple hours that mm-hmm. they're in there, but it's a chance to kind of reorient themselves into Mexico.
Tell us about the Darien Gap. I mean, this has been a big part of the story around migration from South America and Central America for a long time, because it's this incredibly dangerous stretch of jungle, basically, that all of a sudden lots of people were coming through to try to get north and get to the United States eventually. You went to a town there, Bajo Chiquito, which has been a center point for this and kind of has been bolstered by this migrant rush over the last many years. And now it's what? It's empty?
Totally empty. So the very first town that migrants would encounter coming out of the Darien Gap was this town called Bajo Chiquito. It's mm-hmm. a town of less than 400 people. And this whole economy developed around the migrants that were traveling through. More than 1 million migrants passed through the Darien Gap during the 4 years when Biden was the president. But when we were there, there was zero migrants in the town. If we had been there in January, there would have been several thousand migrants living there.
Wow. Wow. So you were witness to these major shifts, these big changes in the migration patterns that are happening right now, which are a direct result of what's happening in our government. And these things happen in migration, like we see changes in these patterns, but not often changes this big. I just want to ask you lastly, Daniel, what your biggest takeaway was. Like, was there a moment that stands out to you that you can't stop thinking about in all of this reporting?
Well, I think the biggest thing that stuck with me is to see the look on these people's faces. These are people who were fleeing very, very horrendous conditions in their own countries. These were people who had left their countries, many times sold everything that they owned to finance these trips to get to the United States. And to see their faces, it was this look of utter despair going back to their home countries, having given up on their American dream.
Yeah. All right. Daniel Gonzalez is an immigration reporter for the Arizona Republic joining us. Daniel, thank you so much. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thanks for having me.
The Valley has been dealing with a housing shortage for several years, and many residents find housing options that are available, either new or existing, are not affordable. My next guest has a potential answer for at least some of those would-be renters, converting empty office space into micro-apartments in co-living spaces. This is a little different than the standard idea of turning vacant offices into apartments. That process can be expensive and difficult to do. Alex Horowitz says in this case, the units would be smaller, more affordable, and cheaper to build. That's due in large part to the ability of developers to better use the existing bones of the building rather than needing to adapt one use to a different one. Horowitz is director of the Housing Policy Initiative at Pew Charitable Trust, which looked at a handful of cities where this kind of development might be possible. He thinks rents in these kinds of units in Phoenix could be around $850 a month. Estimates of average rents in Phoenix vary, but are generally more than $1,000 a month. Horowitz joins me to talk more about this. And Alex, can you please describe the vision here in terms of turning office buildings into co-living spaces? Like, what would these units actually look like?
So Phoenix has a high level of office vacancy, around 23%, and that's above the U.S. average. Office vacancy itself in the U.S. is about the highest it's ever been. And we see that as rents have gotten higher and more people are struggling with housing costs, there is a dream to kind of turn this vacant office space into apartments. But construction costs and layouts have proven too difficult. So we worked with the architecture firm Gensler to identify another path, which is to enable vacant office space to be used as dorm-style housing that would have lower construction costs, smaller unit sizes, and lower rents, where people have private living space, and then you have shared kitchens, laundry, living rooms, bathrooms, and that makes much more efficient use of that vacant office space and has a much lower conversion cost, so rents can be more affordable.
So what would be in sort of the private space itself? Like if I were a renter in one of these, what would my personal space include?
So it would be small, in the neighborhood of 150, 160 square feet typically. And that would mean a bed, a desk, a TV, a half-size refrigerator, a microwave, a pantry, and a closet. Not much more. So something bigger than a college dorm room that two students often share, but much smaller than a regular apartment. Although it would live a little bit bigger because the bathroom and the kitchen would be in the shared interior space of the building and not in the unit itself.
And so as you are describing it as like a college dorm, would it be the kind of thing where you use sort of the existing corridors in an office building and just have units up and down those corridors with bathrooms, you know, sort of sprinkled throughout, as you referenced, a kitchen, you know, here and there, common living spaces, that kind of thing as well?
That's right. So the idea is to make as much use of the existing office building as possible. The most important cost savings from a construction perspective comes from keeping the plumbing in the middle. Part of why it's so expensive to turn vacant office buildings into apartments is moving the plumbing into every unit is a major cost driver. So using as much of the building as possible with those common hallways and then bathrooms, kitchens, laundry, living areas in the middle is what makes this kind of conversion so efficient relative to a regular office conversion into apartments, because not many of those are happening because of high construction costs and poor building layouts.
Is there a demand for this kind of housing? Like, do people who are not in college want to live in places that are like college dorms?
So people are looking for affordable rents. Rents have really never been higher in the U.S. And if you look at Phoenix, going back to 2017, the median rent was under $900. Today, it's around $1,300. So we're seeing households really struggling with affording their monthly bills because rents are so high, the cost to buy is so high. And so is there demand? Well, if the price is right, then there is, because people value living near jobs, living near stores, living near transit. But most of all, they value having something they can afford.
So in your mind, then, the affordability would sort of trump the rest of the considerations in terms of like not having your own private bathroom, for example, or having to share a kitchen with a bunch of other people, things like that.
That's right. So if people can get something, this really is their own space. So they'd be living alone in a private unit, and then they can have as much or as little interaction with other residents as they really want, because they've got a fridge in their unit, they've got a pantry, they've got a microwave. And we're talking about individual shared bathrooms rather than office-style bathrooms. But if we go back in time to, say, the mid-1900s, housing like this was about a tenth of rental units in cities. And that is a housing style which is also more common in cities around the world where it hasn't been outlawed. Berlin, London, Singapore has some housing like this. In Seattle and New York City, Washington, D.C., we're seeing this kind of housing be more common because there's a real demand for something that is well-located, doesn't require much maintenance, comes furnished, and where all of your bills are included in your rent.
So you alluded to this, and I want to ask you more specifically. It sounds like there are cities in the U.S. that are doing this already. How is it working out?
Co-living has been popular in cities where it has kind of not been pushed out by restrictive zoning codes or building codes. So Seattle has seen a lot of housing like this get built in recent years. There's been growth in this area in Washington, D.C., and in New York City, where some of it still exists, even though the city banned creating new units like this in 1955. Now they're taking some steps to re-legalize housing like this, because the units that stayed around, that never disappeared, are really about the most affordable housing that there is in New York City.
How big of a dent do you think that this could put into the housing shortage in the Phoenix metro area if some number of office buildings are converted into this style of housing?
This could make a big difference. 36% of Phoenix renter households have one person, and that is the most undersupplied type of housing. Small housing that is inexpensive and is well located. So if you look at a vacant office building that has a deep floor plate, so that means that there's a lot of surface area on each floor. In cities we've looked at, you can get 50 apartments out of a floor because the units are smaller and they line the perimeter where everybody has a large window. If you were trying to convert these into regular apartments, you could only get 15 or 16 per floor. So you're really tripling the housing potential of a vacant office building by enabling dorm-style housing.
Have you had any conversations with either builders or policymakers here in the Phoenix area to talk to them about this and sort of gauge their interest in doing this?
We have. We've had initial conversations, and it's really just to share the findings of this research. So it'll be up to the city and up to builders in terms of whether they're interested in housing like this. But there's a real advantage to enabling it to come to market. Homelessness has increased dramatically in Arizona broadly and in Phoenix specifically. And when we see that housing costs rise quickly, homelessness follows. So housing like this could stretch subsidy dollars about 2.5 times as far as conventional models. And that means Phoenix could get 2.5 times as many homes per dollar by using subsidies for cost-effective housing like this, rather than more expensive apartments.
All right. That is Alex Horowitz, Director of the Housing Policy Initiative with Pew Charitable Trusts. Alex, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how one playwright used the stage to bring attention to authoritarianism.
But first, Waymo autonomous vehicles are now driving on Valley freeways. The company has announced it's expanding its service in Phoenix, LA, and San Francisco to certain riders who want to take the highway. Waymo says this comes after a year of testing on freeways. It also comes as Tesla has started offering autonomous vehicle rides in Austin, Texas. With me now to talk more about this is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
So how big of a deal is this for Waymo?
I think it's a really big deal. I think this is, Waymo has been kind of locked into small service areas, local roads, and hasn't really been able to act like a real ride-hailing taxi service for years now. And this is really kind of like a first step towards competing on the same level playing field as Uber and Lyft and other taxi services, right? Like, this is going to meaningfully change the way that people use the service. And I think we'll kind of open them up to a broader section of customers as they start to roll out more highway and freeway driving in the cities that they serve.
Yeah, I mean, one of the criticisms, and you've written about this, is that, you know, sometimes the routes that Waymos take are a little, maybe not the routes one would take if they were driving themselves. Does the company think that this will, like, be vastly expanding their business and maybe, as you referenced, expanding the number of customers who might want to use this?
Yeah, they don't really frame it that way, right? They still sort of talk about it in terms of, you know, this is the, you know, how we are approaching these safety cases and how we are sort of gradually expanding our service area. They don't talk about it really in terms of, you know, the types of customers that they get, but they do talk about, you know, the time that they're going to be able to save people, right? That you could really slash a trip, the time that it takes to drive a trip in half potentially by taking highways. So I do think that they do see this in terms of saving people time, and that obviously will, I think, attract more customers and make this a more usable service for a lot more people.
Yeah. Now, I mean, anybody who's driven can tell you that driving on a freeway is a lot different than driving on surface streets. Like, how robust has the testing been? How different is this for a Waymo vehicle to drive on a freeway than it is to drive on a surface street?
Yeah, in some ways, it's easier, right? You don't have intersections or traffic signals or pedestrians and cyclists to deal with. But in some other ways, it's a lot riskier. You're dealing with a lot faster speeds. And so the decisions that get made need to happen a lot quicker than they would they might normally on a local road, because the consequences could be a lot more deadly if something goes wrong. So Waymo seems to be taking this, I think, sort of gradually. They're aware of the safety risks. And they talked about how, you know, for over a decade now, they have been testing on highways, right? This is just something that they've started offering to their customers, but they've been doing this testing on public highways and closed courses, in simulation, where they can simulate certain edge cases where, you know, something random might occur that you might not think about normally occurring on a freeway. And I think that that's how they feel like that they've reached the point now where they're ready to start inviting members of the public into their vehicles on these roads.
Yeah. Do you get the sense that riders are comfortable with this? And I ask because this is a very unscientific survey, just anecdotally asking some friends over the weekend who have taken Waymos and enjoyed it, how they would feel about riding on a freeway. And more than half were like, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, because I think that would be the same probably reaction you would get from someone who has never ridden in Waymo at all, right? Yeah. Would you feel comfortable getting in a car with no one behind the driver's seat? And I think a lot of people might say, maybe not. But after they experience it and they see how it does operate safely in most cases, that it's a pretty conservative driver for the most part. And also sort of the quirks that you get from riding in a robo-taxi, you get to take selfies with it. It has that kind of novelty experience. I think that really kind of has tipped the balance for a lot of people. And I think it's going to be the same with highways, that you're going to start to see more and more people sharing their experiences riding in these vehicles in these situations. And then I think it'll grow from there.
And would you imagine that the plan would be to continue to expand the highway service to more riders, maybe, you know, roll it out in more cities as well at some point?
Yeah, that's what Waymo is saying, that right now that they're limiting the trips to only the people who have opted in on the app, who say that they want to test out these early experiences. So it's not everyone's going to be offered a highway trip right out of the gate. And it's only going to be select highways, I think, as well. I think in Phoenix, they've said that it's going to be Route 60, Interstates 10 and 17 and Loop 202. And then I think we'll see as the map grows, we'll start to see more highways get invited, added in. And then, it's only going to be the three cities as well. They said Phoenix, LA, and San Francisco. So that does not include Austin and Atlanta yet. We're also cities where they operate. So we'll start to see, how the company approaches these other cities and these other markets as time goes on.
So, Andrew, before I let you go, I want to ask about this move by Waymo sort of in the larger AV ecosystem. I mentioned Tesla starting offering autonomous vehicle rides in Austin. And, you know, there's some other companies out there looking to do this as well. How significant is it for Waymo to start doing this sort of now, given where other companies seem to be with this technology?
Yeah, you know, from what my observations, Waymo is still leading the pack. They're far ahead of everyone else. You know, Tesla does offer its service in Austin as well as in the Bay Area, but this is with safety drivers in the vehicle. They have employees that sit in the passenger seat and sometimes behind the wheel itself. They haven't gotten their permits in line yet. You know, as is typical of a Tesla experience, they sort of launch first and then try to get their paperwork all in order afterwards. But yeah, I think that we're going to start to see more and more companies start to do this. Uber has said that they want to, they've been partnering with a bunch of different third-party autonomous vehicle operators. Zoox, which is owned by Amazon, is starting to offer rides in Las Vegas, and they are also testing in San Francisco. So the competition is slowly increasing, but I think Waymo still is seen as being the leader of the pack, given how long they've been doing this and the fact that they are doing it in vehicles without anyone behind the wheel.
Sure. All right. That is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Andrew, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The last penny was minted last week. 232 years after they were first created, the copper coins are no more. It makes sense in some ways. You can't buy anything with a penny anymore, even if you happen to use cash and coins to pay for something. And the Treasury Department said it actually cost more to mint a penny than the penny was even worth. But our next guest sees pennies as worth a little bit more. Local artist Heidi Dauphin has used pennies in her work for decades, and she joins us in studio now to talk more about it. Welcome back to the show, Heidi.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so you have worked with pennies for a long time, as well as a lot of other mediums, but let's talk about your penny date quilt first. So you just finished this, it sounds like, maybe by force, and it's it's made up of pennies literally sewn to the material, and each penny's date has a meaning for you, right?
Yeah, I made it as a response to the quilt show at the Vision Gallery in Chandler, and the theme was minimalism, palette cleanser is the title, and I decided to go back to something I've used a lot, which was pennies, and each square has just one penny. So it's a very subtle quilt, but each penny represents a date that I was alive, starting with when I was born in 1970. And when I made it just a month, 2 months ago, I didn't know 2025 would be the last penny.
Yeah.
But that is this year, and it's called Penny Date Quilt, My Life So Far.
Right. But there are some unfilled squares, right? Like that will,
yes,
I guess, never be filled.
I know. So I made it that it's actually 60 by 60 squares.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted it to be a square. I don't know why I didn't think about making it differently. So there are four squares that now will not have pennies. There's no 2026 penny.
There's no 2026 penny. Okay, so as you mentioned, you've worked with pennies for a long time. Tell us kind of why. Like, what about pennies makes you inspired as an artist?
Well, I think multiples is what inspires me. And so I started working with pennies, I guess, about 20 years ago. I covered a 10-foot fiberglass guitar for Guitar Mania in Phoenix with pennies. And there were about 10,000 pennies. And many people have asked me in the last few days, well, how much is that guitar worth now? So I don't know. You do the math, and now the calculated math, I don't know. But
yeah.
When I was making that, I used pennies in shades, like shiny, medium, dark, like faded. And but while I was making that, I started looking at the dates of pennies. And ever since then, so for the last 20 years, when I see a penny, I look at the date and I kind of think about what happened to me in that year? What does that year represent?
Yeah.
And so then there's a vein of penny art for me that has to do with dates. And that was definitely the penny date quilt that I just made.
Yeah. Where do you find all of these pennies? Especially maybe now, how might you find them in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. Everyone said, do you have enough pennies? And no, I don't. But there's never enough pennies. But I've collected pennies since I was a little kid. I think it was just something, and I've saved them and I've used them. I thought that the guitar would use up the pennies 20 years ago. It did not. But now I feel this need that, like, oh no, they're gone. Like, we might need more. So people do give me pennies. My mom saves pennies for me.
Okay. So
I'm a collector.
So if anyone has a collection of pennies they're looking to get rid of for a good use. It sounds like you're a little sad about this news, though, right? Like, you're sad to say goodbye to the penny?
Oh, yeah, because it's just been, I don't know, it's been a part of my life. Like, and it's a part of my art. And so it ends this year. So mm-hmm. I didn't know that when I was making, I knew it was coming. They talked about it. But when I made this quilt, I did not know this was it. So now it even means any more. And maybe there has to be another date penny piece before the end of the year. I don't know. That represents 2025. So
let me ask you kind of how this is a sign of the times, right? Like, everything is digital now, including our money. So, like, what does it mean to you? How do you think about the penny as not just a date, right, which you talked about, but this, like, physical thing that, you know, you use in this physical way that you could not use a credit card?
Yeah. Oh, that's a big question. I think about that a lot. In a lot of my art, I've focused on handwriting, too, that we don't use handwriting anymore and how that's important. I save lists. I was interviewed here before about that. So it's just another sign of the times. Like, there is no more physical penny. When will there be no more physical change, really? I mean, it's mm-hmm. becoming obsolete. So, like, just different things that comes up in my art that are no longer available to us. But I guess I didn't start using those things with that intention, but now it becomes clearer and more important to me.
Yeah.
The physicality of art has always been, my background is in clay, and so I do like a tactile thing. I'm interested in materials, both made and collected.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Absolutely. Let me ask you lastly what you might do with pennies going forward. Now, I mean, they have a very different meaning now that they're no longer being made. They are obsolete in this way they weren't when you started this 20 years ago. What do you think?
Everything's changed in like 4 days. I do have a pipe dream of a project that is there. I have a 1977 Volkswagen Beetle in the back of my car that I've always wanted to cover with pennies.
An entire car.
But it's little. Those cars are little.
They are little, but still
but,
a car.
So now that's become a little more important. I'm not sure. But I don't have enough pennies for that. So that's the first thing that comes to mind. But right. I do think I need to do something more with dates also.
It might add another layer to the meaning of all of this work too, huh?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's sad. There's not going to be a 2026 penny.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there.
Okay.
That is local artist Heidi Dauphin joining us to talk about the end of the penny. Thank you so much, Heidi. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Forces from a number of NATO countries will be holding live trials this week of anti-drone technology. Those tests will be held in Germany and come as that country deals with a heated public debate over the size of its armed forces and a plan to introduce some level of military conscription. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. And Rob, what's the story with all this?
Well, Mark, all of this comes back to the war between Russia and Ukraine, which, of course, we get new headlines for pretty well every day. If you look today, for example, the Polish prime minister has been saying that there's been a sabotage attack in his country on a railway line that connects Poland to Ukraine. So, in other words, when Poland's been sending aid to Ukraine along that railway line, someone doesn't like that very much and has disrupted or sabotaged the railway line. At the same time, we see Mr. Zelensky of Ukraine has just met with the French leader, and they've agreed that the French will supply Ukraine with 100 fighter jets in the coming years. I mean, these sorts of headlines we see pretty well every day. So the Ukraine-Russia war is front and center. One reason why it is because there is an exchange of drones in particular between both of those countries, armed drones, on a pretty much a regular daily basis. And of course, Europe is concerned about this as well, because these are armed drones between Russia and Ukraine, and unarmed drones have been seen in lots of European countries now. It's quite a regular thing that's been going on. And it's really bothered NATO, it's bothered European countries. And so this coming week, what we're going to see is in Poland and Germany and the Baltic states, so Latvia, Lithuania, and indeed up in Finland, we're going to see anti-drone technology tried out in order to try and stop what they perceive as being drones from Russia or from Russian assets in Europe, bothering, if you like, critical infrastructure, airports and so on in European countries. So that's in the kind of foreground. An interesting side story to all of this is that in Germany, just a couple of days ago, they've announced a new military plan. And that's because the coalition government in Germany wants to build what it says it wants to build, the largest armed forces in Europe, which is quite interesting. And the way they plan on doing that is by sending questionnaires to every 18-year-old in Germany, male or female. The men are going to be obligated to fill in that questionnaire and also undergo a medical screening. Why? Because Germany wants to increase its armed forces and wants to get more young men in particular enlisted. And it's said that if it doesn't get the adequate numbers, if it doesn't meet its target, then it may be looking towards some form of conscription in due course. And so we're seeing that in Germany as part of all of this, but it's driven by the war in Russia and Ukraine.
Interesting. So, Rob, let's go now to Bangladesh, where earlier today, a court in that country issued a verdict in the trial of the country's former leader, a pretty highly controversial person. And this trial and result was being watched pretty carefully across South Asia. Can you tell us more about this?
Well, that's right. So Bangladesh, very big country, 170-odd million people. And Sheikh Hasina used to be the leader of that country. She led the country for 15 years. She was actually a sort of considered a Democrat originally and a very keen on a multi-party system and democracy and so on. But as her rule progressed, it became more authoritarian to the point where last summer, in the summer of 2024, there was a student-led protest movement against the government, against her government in Bangladesh. And the security forces opened fire on those protesters. And the UN says, the United Nations says, that as many as 1,400 people were killed. And in fact, I've heard it said by some commentators that this was Tiananmen Square for Bangladesh. It had the same sort of effect across the country, 1,400, mainly young people, killed by the authorities. Sheikh Hasina was ousted as a result of this, and she fled to India, and she's been living in Delhi since then. Well, today, the trial of her that's been going on in Dhaka in Bangladesh for all of this, you know, did she order the security forces to open fire on these people? That's the allegation which she has denied. And by the way, she's called the court kangaroo court and politically motivated and all that. Well, anyway, today the court handed down a verdict of guilty, and they also passed a death sentence against her in absentia. So this means that if she were to re-enter the country to Bangladesh, she would be arrested and possibly executed because of this. It's also thrown up an issue between Bangladesh and India because they have an extradition treaty. So Bangladesh, of course, is now saying, we want you to extradite Sheikh Hasina back to Bangladesh. But India is unlikely to do that for a number of different reasons. But it's a very big story across South Asia today.
Sure. Rob, let's go now to Spain, where on Thursday, Spain will mark 50 years since the death of its former dictator, Francisco Franco. His shadow, of course, still lingers in that country. And there's sounds like a pretty big debate about the building of a new mausoleum to him.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So those listeners who don't quite know, but Franco was the dictator of Spain from 1939, the 1st of April 1939, until his death in 1975. And so he led the nationalists in the Spanish Civil War just before that. When the war came to an end, he became the ruler of Spain, and he ruled that country for 36 years. Being a military man, he did so with a fair amount of authority, which became more and more repressive. Tens of thousands of people lost their lives under the Franco dictatorship and so on. And so when he died and he was buried in a huge mausoleum very near the capital, Madrid, there was an outpouring of grief by some people because they saw him as a great leader who kind of solidified Spain, kept Spain together, and also brought Spain a degree of prosperity. Living standards increased under Franco. But the other side hated Franco and thought he was repressive, authoritarian, a dictator. Interestingly, Spain was neutral in World War II, but it was nonetheless getting a lot of support from the Nazis and from fascist Italy and so on. That gives you some idea. And so Spain was always divided over Franco. And what's so interesting is as we approach the 50th anniversary of the death of Franco back in November 20th, 1975, Spain is still divided about Franco, remarkably, to the point where this mausoleum outside Madrid, his remains were buried there back in 1975, but they were removed from there a few years ago. And that's because of the sensitivities about having him there in amongst a number of his opponents who were also buried there. So that gives you some idea of how the shadow of Franco still lingers in Spain.
Well, that'll be interesting to keep an eye on going forward. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The British playwright Harold Pinter made his name in the middle of the 20th century with a series of biting social satires. His plays were sarcastic and funny, lampooning the awkwardness and absurdity of British life. But towards the end of his life, the tone of Pinter's plays began to change. ASU professor Dennis Russell has a book out about Pinter's transformation. It's called Harold Pinter, Fascism and Outrage. And Russell recently spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman about it. Starting in the 1980s, Russell writes, Pinter saw governments around the world tilting toward authoritarianism, and he decided he had to do something.
Against the backdrop of this rise of global fascism, Harold Pinter wrote this series of overt, graphically brutal, graphically realistic set of anti-fascism plays. And in my analysis, I in part found that it seemed like on stage he was engaging in what I referred to as an alternative dramaturgical form of journalism.
Would you say that the realism that he pursued in these productions was perhaps augmented by the sort of surreal nature of actual political news and the culture that rises up around authoritarianism, where it starts to feel in those contexts like it's difficult to trust actual journalism sometimes, or it's difficult to trust actual, you know, information coming from the media. And so the idea of being more rigorous about realism in a fictional dramatization of events like this can perhaps counterintuitively feel more reliable.
And that's precisely it, Sam. Pinter in these plays, he's portraying reporters who are essentially silent and oblivious about the fascism that is taking place in their country. They're asking questions that lack meaning and lack empathy. And essentially, Pinter is portraying the press as accomplices. And in fact, Pinter became so disturbed about what he was hearing about fascism in other countries, that he, in fact, went to various countries such as Turkey, where fascist regimes were using fascist techniques, brutal techniques, did his own research, interviewed political prisoners, interviewed political activists who had been tortured. And then he came back to his home country of Britain, so impacted by this research that it had dramatically altered his writing style. His earlier plays, like The Room, The Birthday Party, The Dumb Waiter, The Homecoming, those earlier works were more psychological, metaphorical styled plays. He came to the conclusion, I can't write in this style anymore.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting. You know, you were describing his process in the example of Turkey. You used the word research, but the specifics of what you described could also be characterized as reporting, you know, going to the place where something is happening, talking to sources on the ground, coming back and using what you've learned from those conversations to produce a piece of media that expresses the urgency of a situation. And if you wouldn't mind, Dennis, I think it might be good to go to a specific example of what you're talking about here to give folks a sense of it. In the second chapter of your book, you write about how this manifests itself in the Pinter play, One for the Road.
Yes, very much so. So One for the Road, which is a play that he wrote in 1984, it contains four short, brutal scenes. And the setting for this play, One for the Road, there's an interrogator in an unnamed fascist regime by the name of Nicholas. During the four scenes of this play, he is essentially tormenting an already tortured political prisoner, as well as tormenting his imprisoned wife and child.
What's the matter? What in heaven's name is the matter? You're probably just hungry or thirsty. Let me tell you something. I hate despair. I find it intolerable. The stink of it gets up my nose. It's a blemish. Despair, old fruit, is a cancer. It should be castrated. Indeed, I've often found that that works.
And the setting for this play, One for the Road, it's simply a stark, antiseptic interrogation room. The prisoner's chair and the interrogator's desk, and it's just filled with dialogue. One for the Road is very emblematic of what a number of these other plays are like.
As you were pointing out, Pinter's earlier works were much more absurdist comedies with a lot of wordplay and kind of like cultural satire.
What are you reading?
Someone's just had a baby.
Oh, they haven't. Who?
Some girl.
Oh, who, Petey? Who?
I don't think you'd know her.
Well, what's her name?
Lady Mary Splatt.
I don't know her.
No.
Absolutely. In fact, Pinter himself had remarked about his earlier plays that these earlier plays of his were filled with psychological games and jokes.
Uh-huh.
And then when he came back from Turkey and some of these other countries doing his firsthand research, he was quoted as saying, "I'm afraid that for me, the joke is over." It's interesting that reading various interviews with Pinter about these works, he mentioned it himself that, you know, earlier in his career, he had always been very suspect of what he might think of as maybe kind of a propaganda form of theater,
right,
and that he never himself wanted to engage in it. And he had an artistic and intellectual sea change in which he doesn't see these works as propagandistic. He sees these as, you know, on stage displaying at a very realistic, heightened level of the realities of what's taking place in fascist regimes.
Yeah, I mean, the way we're talking about it, Dennis, it almost seems like he viewed these almost as documentary plays, with the notable and important difference that, you know, the actual events that he was depicting were imaginary.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a strong documentary feel to these plays. And I ultimately argue in my book, Sam, that the fact overwhelms the fiction. I think Pinter was thinking that many, many people are just totally oblivious to the realities of fascism that are taking place on this planet. And that I think he saw these set of plays as serving as at least a consciousness raising. So I think they're very valuable in that regard.
Well, Dennis Russell is associate professor at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications, and we've been talking about his new book, Harold Pinter, Fascism and Outrage, Aesthetic and Moral Implications. Dennis, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can find the sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.